Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a conversation recorded in 1978 between legendary economist Friedrich Hayek and former economics writer Elaine Carver Leyenhoud. During the conversation, the two talk about Hayek's memories of traveling to America as a young man, as well as his perception about the tensions between religious and scientific thought. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Before, it's not so hard for an American student with a doctorate to realize how difficult it can be to get a university post. But still, it's hard for us to realize how hard it was. I think it'd be helpful if you could tell us exactly if you had hopes of an academic career.
Yes.
How likely it was to realize it.
It would never have been an academic career from the beginning in the then Austrian conditions, unless you were in one of the experimental fields where you could get a paid assistantship. Until you got a professorship, you could not live from an income and academic career, you see. The aim would be to get what I best describe as a license to lecture, as a so-called Privatdozent, who was allowed to lecture, but who practically earned no money. When I finally achieved it, what I got from students' fees just served to pay my taxi, which I had to take once a week from my office to give a lecture at the university. That's all I got from the university. So outside the exact sciences, there wasn't a sense no academic career, but you had to find an occupation outside which enabled you to devote enough time to your work. And in fact, the whole crowd of my friends in the social sciences, law and so on, were all people who were earning their income elsewhere and aiming at the Privatdozent to earn, but then even for years continue, at the same time have a bread-earning occupation and on the side do academic work.
Yes.
That was particularly marked in Vienna because, as we talked about yesterday, you had this large intellectual Jewish community, most of whom could not really hope to get a university post. So in the circle in which I lived, I mean, my closest friends were either practicing lawyers, the philosopher and mathematician was a director of Anglo-Persian Oil Company in Vienna. Another one, a sociologist, was the secretary of one of the banking associations. One or two were actually in some lower civil service positions. But among my friends, I don't think a single one who up to the middle 30s or late 30s could live from his income as an academic position. Even if they acquired the lectureship, it didn't mean they could live on that. They lived on something, some other income which may have been completely unconnected with academic activities. So even if you aimed at ultimately a professorship, your immediate concern was to find something else which you could combine with academic activities. And what I finally got was a pure accident. I think I did not expect till the very last moment that in a newly created governmental office, which was comparatively well paid because it required a combination of law, economics and languages, which was rather rare, and which gave me, for the first 5 years, a comparatively well paid position in Vienna. But except that, as I mentioned yesterday, it brought me into contact with Mises, it has nothing to do with my academic ambitions.
There could be roadblocks even in getting accepted as a privat docent.
Oh yes, of course, you were very much dependent on the sympathy or otherwise of the professor in charge. You had to find what was called a Habilitationsfather, a man who would sponsor you. And if you didn't happen to agree with the professor in charge, and there were usually only two or three, in fact, even in a big subject like economics, three professors, unless one of you liked you, well, there just was no possibility.
I thought it might be useful if you gave the names of some rather famous men who were at the university and who never were anything more than Privatdozent, not only economics, but in other fields.
Well, in law, it wouldn't mean anything because they were very eminent, but a specialist Austrian lawyer has no international reputation. But Heinrich Gompertz, the philosopher, for instance, is a clear instance. Well, even Mises, my teacher, when he had such a good position that I doubt whether he would have wished to start at the lower level even of an extraordinary professor, but it was a great chagrin to him that it was never offered to him. But again, the medical faculty was full of such men who had academic ambitions, who did little teaching at the university, but made their income as practicing doctors. There were even one or two distinguished mathematicians whose names I do not know, who, partly because of a shortage of positions, partly because of anti-Jewish prejudice, were part and at the same time not part of the university. I mean, that really created a large extent of peculiar intellectual atmosphere of Vienna that it was not confined to the people who were actually inside the university. So many people had just a foot in the university, which meant there was a large intellectual audience to whom you could speak who were not solely or mainly professors, but who gave you an audience of general interests, which I don't think of the same character would found anywhere else. And it was not even, I mean, I emphasized the anti-Semitism as one of the causes, but it wasn't only that. The tradition that you might do scholarly work on the side, yes, with a practical occupation became quite general, perhaps because of the example of the people who were kept out, but there were any number of people who were, in other countries, might have been private scholars with a private income, but there were a few wealthy people of that kind, could were one or two, but there were mostly people who had decided to earn their living outside the university, yet to pursue their scholarly interests.
So this gave Vienna a very lively intellectual life, and much of that was going on outside the university.
Outside and in little circles. Uh-huh. You probably wouldn't be aware that there was such a large community because it never met as a whole. When there were all sorts of scientific societies and discussion clubs, but even they were in a curious way split up, and that again was connected with the what you might call race problem, the anti-Semitism. It was a purely non-Jewish group. It was an almost purely Jewish group, and a small intermediate group where the two groups mixed. And that split up the society. On the other hand, as I only become recently aware, the leading people were really a very small group of people who somehow were connected with each other. It was only a short while ago when somebody like you do now inquired about whom I knew about the famous people of Vienna, the purpose, and I began to go through the list and I found I knew almost every one of them personally, and with most of them I was somehow connected by friendship or family relations and so on. And I think the discussion then began, did you know Schrödinger? Oh yes, of course, Schrödinger was the son of a colleague of my father and came as a young man in our house, or Frisch, the B. Frisch. Oh yes, he was the youngest of a group of friends of my father, so we knew the family quite well. And Lawrence, oh yes, I know the whole family, and I've seen Lawrence washing ducks when he was 3 years old. And so it went on, and every one of the people who are now famous has, except, again, the purely Jewish one. Freud and his circle I never had any contact with. They were a different world.
But you had this intermediate group who were Jewish, yes, or who had who were part Jewish, as Herbert Firth
one
told
did,
me.
One married. Did always hear about what happens, yes, in the, but didn't know the people personally.
Yes. Yeah. I certainly got this impression from reading Karl Popper also, oh, yeah, on how small the group was, yes, and how I don't know if he was the one who mentioned it, how Bruckner, for example, might be playing the piano for someone else who is a philosopher.
Bruckner, see again, there were curious bridges. The Wittgensteins had a great musical salon. Mm-hmm. Now the Wittgensteins themselves were three-quarter Jewish, but Ludwig Wittgenstein's grandmother was the sister of my great-grandfather, so we were again related. I personally was too young. See, the Wittgenstein salon ended with the outbreak of war. Both the old man had died, and after the breakdown, it never reassembled. But that was one of the centers where art and science met in a very wealthy background. And where again, it was one of the bridges between the two societies.
When you were a young man at this time, let's say about when you were finishing your degree in economics in the Faculty of Law, which is how it was organized, what were your dreams, your fantasies of what you might do with your career?
Well, at that time, I really wanted a job in which I could do scientific work on society. That was the main problem. It was a little later that I formed an idea, and I once made the joke to my first wife, or I think just before we married, that if I could plan my life, I would like to begin as a professor of economics in London, which was the center of economics, doing this for 10 or 15 years, then return to Austria as president of the National Bank, and ultimately go back to London as an Austrian ambassador. Now, the most unlikely thing happened that I got a professorship in London, which I thought was absolutely a wish dream of the unlikely nature. Even the second step, also not at that time, 40 years later, I was once negotiating about the presidency of the Austrian National
Bank. Oh, you were?
Yes. It did not come off.
Yeah. This means you were an Anglophile early. What made you an Anglophile, do you think?
Why was it as early as that? I really can't say. Once I got to England, which was very soon, I think it must have been after this. I had been from the first visit to England before that happened. It was just a temperamental similarity. I felt at home among English because it was similar temperament. And which, of course, is not general feeling, but I think most Austrians I know who have lived in England acclimatized extraordinarily easily. There must be some similarity of traditions, but I didn't easily adapt to another country. She had been in America before I ever came to England.
Yeah.
I was here as a graduate student in 23 and 24, and although I found it extremely stimulating, and even knew I could have started on as an assistantship or something on an academic career, I didn't want to. I still was too much a European and didn't the least feel that I belonged to this society. By the moment I arrived in England, I belonged to it.
Well, was the intellectual life, let's say we talked a bit about Vienna and the circles and the intellectual life outside the university, did England, when you went there, have more of that than what you saw when you were in the United States?
Yes, it had more, although it wasn't quite the same. Yeah, I might have had more of it if I'd gone to one of the old universities or even one of the less specialized colleges of the University of London. The London School of Economics, which first was an attraction to me, was extremely good in the social sciences, but it was completely specialized to social sciences. While at first, moving among very good people in my field was very attractive. I admit at the end of 20 years, I longed to get back to a general university atmosphere, which the London School of Economics is not. It is very much a specialized school where you live all the time amongst other social scientists and see nobody else.
I had a question here. Many young men of your generation had been socialists when they were young, or at least social democrats. Had you been influenced at one time?
Oh, yes,
by
very much so. I know it was a social democrat formerly, but I would have been what in England would have been described as a Fabian socialist. And the special influence, in fact, an influence which very much contributed to keep me interested in economics, were the writings of a man called Walter Rathenau, who was an industrialist and later statesman and finally a politician in Germany, who wrote extremely well, who had been a raw material dictator in Germany during the war and had become an enthusiastic planner. And I think his ideas about how to reorganize the economy were probably the beginning of my interest in economics. And they were very definitely mildly socialist. And I just found the... Well, perhaps I should say I found I knew too little to judge it. That's what made me interested in economics. I mean, how realistic were these socialist plans, which I found very attractive. So there was a great deal of socialist inclination which led me to... I never got captured by Marxist socialism, on the contrary. Then I counted socialism in its Marxist, frightfully doctrinaire form, and the Vienna socialists, Marxists, were more doctrinaire than most other places. It rather repelled me. But of that mild kind, either of German socialpolitik type, the state socialism, or the Rathenau type, was one of the inducements which led me to the study of economics.
I see. A number of people, I've talked to a number of people who went through the University of Vienna in this period, and a number of them have spoken, in fact some from the German universities also, have spoken of the influential role, once they were studying economics, of Mises, I think it's a 1919 article on the problems of economic calculation.
I think it was 1920.
I'm sorry.
Disputed with you.
You would know better.
Yes, it was that article, and then particularly the book in which it was embodied, the Gemeinwirtschaft, now translated as socialism, which had the decisive influence of curing us, although it was a very long struggle. At first, we all felt he was frightfully exaggerating and even offensive in tone, because he hurt all our deepest feelings. But gradually, he won us round, although for a long time I had to... I just learned he was usually right in his conclusions, but I was not completely satisfied with his argument. And that, I think, followed me right through my life. I was always influenced by Mises' answers, but not fully satisfied by his arguments. So it became then very largely an attempt to improve the argument, which I realized led to correct conclusions, but the question why it hadn't persuaded most other people became a problem to me, so I became anxious to put it in a more effective form.
I see. I'm going to move into maybe a slightly different area, but it still pertains to it. In the economics faculty, prior to the First World War, it had had a grand reputation that it started with Menger, and then there was Visser and Bombaverk. Now, when you came into economics after the First World War, what was the situation at that time?
At first it was dreadful, but only for a year. There was nobody there. Wieser had left the university to become a minister in the last Austrian governments. Bombaverk had died shortly before. Filipowicz, another great figure, had died shortly before. So when I arrived, there was nobody but a socialist economic historian named Grünberg. Then Wieser came back, and he became my teacher. He was a most impressive teacher. very distinguished man whom I came to admire very much. I mean, I think that's the only instance where the very young men do, I just fell for a particular teacher. He was the great admired figure, sort of grandfather figure, about two generations between us. Very kindly man who usually would, I would say, float high above the students, the soul of God. But when he took an interest, the student became extremely helpful and kind, took me in the family. I was asked to have meals with him and so on. So he was for a long time my ideal in the field, and from whom I got my main general introduction into economics.
How did he take notice of you? How did that happen?
Well, there are two aspects of it. I first flattered myself that I had gone up to him once or twice after the lecture to ask an intelligent question, but later I became to doubt whether it was more the fact that he knew I was one of his closest friends.
I know that there were three chairs at the university, and Wieser retired at what
well,
time?
Well, I'm afraid Wieser made himself responsible for rather poor appointments. The first one was Ottmar Spann, a very curious mind, an original mind, himself originally still a pupil of Menger, but a very emotional person who moved from an extreme socialist position to an extreme nationalist position and ended up as a devout Roman Catholic, always with rather fantastic philosophical ideas. He soon ceased to be interested in technical economics and was developing what he called a universalist social philosophy. But he, being a young and enthusiastic man, for a very short time, had a considerable influence on all those young people. Well, he would do the sort of thing, take us to a midsummer celebration up in the woods where we jumped over fires and that sort of thing.
Oh, I didn't know.
But it didn't last long because we soon discovered that he really didn't have to tell us anything about economics. Well, as long as I was there, there were only these two professorships. And of course, when Wieser retired, which happened in the year when I finished my first degree, he was succeeded by Hans Meyer, his favorite disciple, an extremely thoughtful man, but a bad neurotic, a man who could never do anything on time, who was always late for any appointment, for every lecture, who never completed the things he was working on. In a way, a tragic figure. I mean, a man who had been very promising, and perhaps it's unjust to blame Wieser for appointing him, because everybody thought that a great deal would come from him. And probably there is still more in his very fragmentary work than is still appreciated. But one of his defects was that he worked so intensely on the most fundamental basic problems of utility and value that he never had time for anything else in economics. So he was, in a sense, a narrow figure. The third professorship was only filled a year or two after I had left. The man, Count Degenfeld, he played a certain role when I finally got my Privatdozent to it, but I'd never had any contact with him otherwise. There were a few Privatdozent or men with the title of professor like Mises, but my contact with him was entirely outside the university. And no, the faculty, except for Wieser as a person, as an individual, the economics professor were not very distinguished, really. It was a great tradition which Wieser kept up, but except for him, the economics part of the university was not very distinguished.
When I look at this period, a lot of people, this is true also before the war and for those who were young men after the war, often describe themselves as positivists or anti-positivists. And I have difficulty in knowing what positivism actually meant at that time. And I wondered.
Well, it was almost entirely the influence of Ernst Mach, the physicist, and his disciples. He was the most influential figure philosophically. And almost in that time, apart from what I've been reading, before I joined the army, I think my introduction to. Well, then I almost hesitate to call it philosophy. Scientific method, I think, is a better description. Was into Machian philosophy, who was also very good on the history of science generally. And it dominated discussion in Vienna. For instance, Schumpeter had fully fallen for Mach. And while I was still at the university, this very interesting figure, Moritz Schlick, became one of the professors of philosophy. That was the beginning of the Vienna Circle, of whom I was, of course, never a member, but we were in close contact with it through one man who was both a member of our particular circle, the Geistkreis, and the Schlick Circle, the Vienna Circle proper, so we're currently informed of what was happening there.
That was Professor.
And for a time, well, what converted me is that the social scientist, science specialist in that group, Otto Neurath, just was so extreme and so naive on economics that it was through him that I became aware that positivism just was misleading in the social sciences. I owe it to his extreme position that I have soon recognized that it wouldn't do. And it took me a long time, really, to emancipate myself from it. And it was only after I'd left Vienna, in London, that I began to think systematically on problems of methodology of the social sciences and began to recognize that positivism in that field was definitely misleading. And it was a discussion I had on a visit to Vienna from London with my friend Haberle, in which I explained to him that I had come to the conclusion that all this Machian positivism was no good for our purposes, when he countered, oh, there's a very good new book that came out in the circle of Vienna positivists by a man called Karl Popper on the logic of scientific research. And so I became one of the early readers. It just came up out a few weeks before. Found that Howard had been rather mistaken by the setting in which the book had appeared. While it came formally out of that circle, it was really an attack on the system. And to me, it was so satisfactory because it confirmed the certain view I had already formed due to an experience very similar to Karl Popper. Karl Popper is 4 or 5 years my junior, so we did not belong to the same academic generation. But the environment in which we formed our ideas was very much the same. It was very largely dominated by a discussion, on the one hand with Marxists, and the other hand with Freudians. And both these groups had one very irritating attribute. They insisted that their theories were in principle irrefutable. The system was so built up that there was no possibility. And I remember particularly one occasion when I suddenly began to see how ridiculous it all was when I was arguing with Freudians, and they explained, oh, well, this is due to the death instinct. And then I said, but this can't be due to, oh, this is due to the life instinct. Well, if you have these two alternatives, of course, there's no way of checking whether the theory is true or not. And that led me already to the understanding of what became Popper's main systematic point, that the test of empirical science was that it could be refuted, and that any system which claimed that it was irrefutable was by definition not scientific. I was not a trained philosopher, I didn't elaborate this, it was sufficient for me to have recognized this, but when I found the thing explicitly argued and justified in Popper, I just accepted the Popperian philosophy as if we were spelling out what I'd always felt. And ever since, I mean, I have been moving with Popper. We became ultimately very close friends, although we had not known each other in Vienna. And to a very large extent, I agree, even if not always immediately. Popper has had his own interesting developments, but on the whole, I agree with him more than with anybody else on philosophical matters.
Do you think you reacted to this kind of dogmatism also because of your rejection of this form of dogmatism in the Church, in the Roman Catholic Church?
Possibly, although that I had so completely overcome by that time that it really never... You see, that goes back so far in my family. I mean, if you begin with, thanks so much, if you have a grandfather who is an enthusiastic Darwinian,
I see.
A father who is also a biologist, a maternal grandfather who evidently also believed in nothing, because he never spoke about it, and one grandmother who was very devoted to the ceremonial of the Catholic Church, but was so evidently not really interested in the purely religious aspect of it. And then I was very young, I must have been in my 13 or 14, when I began pestering all the priests I knew to explain to me what they meant by the word God. And none of them could. That was the end for me of it.
Yes. Was this true of most of the intellectuals in these circles we were talking about, that they had, that they weren't people who had rebelled, let's say, against Roman Catholicism, but came from families who had a sort of enlightened background?
Yes, it was predominantly due. It was very rare in that circle to find anybody who had any definite religious beliefs. In fact, they were, I think, in university circles, a very small minority who, by having these beliefs, almost isolated themselves from the rest. Well, let me just go back to my earlier development, which I have, some things have recurred to me since I talked to Mr. Lermont yesterday. He asked me when my interest in social sciences really began. And I thought I had to say only with World War I, which isn't quite correct. I remembered a very specific occasion, which must have been a few weeks probably before I joined the army, when we had a class in the elements of philosophy, logic and logical propudeutic, as it was called. And he gave a sort of survey of the history of philosophy and was speaking about Aristotle and explained to us that Aristotle defined ethics as consisting of three parts. I believe it was morals, politics, and economics. When I heard this, well, these are the things I want to study. And it had one rather comic after effect. I went home and told my father, I know what I'm going to study. I'm going to study ethics. He was absolutely shocked by the idea. And it had a curious after effect. A few days later, he brought me three volumes of the philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, whom he'd seen in the shop window of a second-hand bookseller, who was, of course, at that time an outright positivist, so of a rather crude kind. And in order to cure me of my belief in ethics, Well, I think all the effects was an attempt to read this book gave me a very definite distaste for philosophy for some time. But, of course, what I had meant by ethics wasn't at all what my father understood when I mentioned the term. But it does mean that as early as probably late 1916, when I was 17, I was clear that my main interests were in the social sciences. And the transition must have come fairly quickly. I do remember roughly that until 15 or so, I was purely interested in biology. Originally, what my father did systematically, well, he was mainly a plant geographer, what is now ecology. But the taxonomic part soon did not satisfy me. And at one stage, when my father discovered this, he put a little too early in my hand what was then a major treatise on the theory of evolution, something called Descendants Theory. I believe it was by De Vries. I think it was just a bit too early. At 14 or 15, I was not yet ready to follow a sustained theoretical argument. If he had given me this a year later, I probably would have stuck with biology. Things did interest me intensely, but in fact my interests very rapidly moved then, some extent already in evolution. For a while I played with paleontology. We had in our circle of friends a very distinguished paleontologist, in fact two, one ordinary one and one insect paleontologist. Then I knew somehow I got interested in psychiatry. And it seems it was via psychiatry that sometimes I got to these problems of political order. One of my great desires had been to get a very expensive volume which described, as it were, the organizations of public life. I wanted to learn how society was organized. I remember, I've never read it, contained a chapter on government and one on the press and one about information. And so I turned to certain practical aspects of social life. As I may have had in general, up to my student days and time at the university, my tendency was very definitely practical. I wanted to be efficient. My ideal for a long time was that of a fireman's horse. I once did see how, before the time of the automobile, the fire equipment was, the horse was standing in its stable, ready to be put on the cart with the everything hanging over it, so it required only two or three pressing of buttons and the horse was finished to go out. And that's I must be like that, ready for every possibility in life and be very efficient. Just as in the various sports, which are mountaineering, climbing, skiing, cycling, photography, I was for a time extremely interested in technical efficiency of this kind, thing which I completely lost later in my life.
Did you read Taylor then? Was Taylor being read in your circles at all? The American?
Yes, there was a stage in which I was reading all the Taylor stuff.
Uh-huh.
But that was a little later. I think it was the beginning of my economics reading, but that was a great time of the great fashion of Taylorism. But I had this passion for understanding all sorts of functioning and organization of complicated phenomena. I mention this because nowadays all my friends think I'm completely indifferent to technical things. I'm no longer really interested, but I had a great passion for them at one time.
I think when you were still at the university, you would go over to lectures sometimes. Was it in psychiatry or in the biology department?
In anatomy.
In anatomy?
Anatomy, yes. It was largely in connection with my then growing interest in physiological psychology. Then, well, I had easy access. My brother was studying in the anatomy department, so I just gate-crashed into lectures occasionally and even in the dissecting room.
Was it common for students at that time to gate-crash in lectures in another discipline outside of their own specialization?
Oh, very common, yes. I mean, very common again. In those, that part of the students who were really intellectually interested, who were substantial. But of course, if you take a faculty like law, I suppose in the law faculty in Vienna in my time, there were something like 2,000 or 3,000 students, of whom perhaps 300 had really intellectual interests, and the others just wanted to get through their exams. You can't generalize about the students, but that small group certainly did not specialize solely to one discipline, but sampled all the way around. I mean, I would go to lectures on biology, to lectures on art history, to lectures on philosophy, certainly, and certain biological lectures. I sampled around even with, I mean, I sometimes marvel how much I could do in the 3 years, when you say, I mentioned before, I mean, my official study was law. I did all my exams with distinction in law, and yet I divided my time about equally between economics and psychology. Mm-hmm. And went to all these other lectures and the theatre every evening almost.
You didn't see this when you came to the United States for that year?
Oh no. This sort of life was completely absent. But it was also, of course, in the United States, I was so desperately poor that I couldn't do anything. I mean, I didn't see anything of what the cultural life of New York was because I couldn't afford to go anywhere. And I had no real contacts. You see, I wasn't a regular student. I was sitting in the New York Public Library and there were 4 or 5 people on the same desk who I came to know, but that was the total of my acquaintance and of my acquaintance with Americans. I met a few Austrian families, but I had really very little contact with American life during that year, merely because of a financial limitation. And I was so poor that my dear old mother used to remind me to the end of her life that when I came back from America, I wore 2 pairs of socks, one over the other, because each had so many holes that it was the only way.
Do you think, because of this, in your case, you were also poor, as you say, when you were a student in America, but do you think the fact that you and many other economists I know from Vienna were so reluctant to come to take a position in America, even though it was an academic position, do you think this was partly related to what they had observed
here? No, it doesn't apply to the others. See, I was the only one who did not come over in the comfort of a Rockefeller Foundation. All the later visitors visited America very comfortably and could travel and see everything. My case was unique. I was the only one who came on his own, at his own risk, and with practically no money to spare, and who lived for the whole of a 15-month period on $60 a month. I mean, it wasn't... it would have been miserable if I hadn't known that if I was in a real difficulty, I would just cable my parents, please send me the money for return. But apart from this confidence that nothing could really happen to me,